From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 340, Internal IPv6 Networks, with guest Venkat Kalyanasundaram, recorded Wednesday, October 23rd, 2013. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. Recording this on a sunny Tuesday. I'm actually home for a week after lots and lots of travel. And my guest today is Venkat Kalyanasundaram. And Venkat is a senior premier field engineer from Microsoft. He's in the New York region, and his focus is on various platform technologies like Active Directory, networking in Windows for different customers around the New York region. Venkat's also a subject matter expert in the IPv6 area and delivers training on IPv6 for both internal and external folks. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
So this IPv6 thing, we've talked about it a few times here and there, and it always sort of comes back to, until the ISPs move, it's just not going to matter all that much. Or does it make a big difference internally?
Okay, before I go ahead and answer that question, maybe I'll take a step back and just talk about just IPv6, just to give you a quick background.
Sure.
When we talk about the IPv6 migration, we are not talking about a typical migration that people are used to. Meaning, what I mean by that is, okay, till Friday, your network is running on IPv4. Now, come Monday after the weekend, now everything is going to get magically switched over to IPv6.
Right.
That's the typical migration that people have that in their mindset. But the IPv6 migration is not going to be like that. So just to take a step further, it's going to be, for the most part, a parallel migration, or what I call it as a parallel deployment, mm-hmm. on top of your existing IPv4 network.
Well, and aren't most folks running IPv6 now if they've got anything newer than Server 2003 R2? I mean, all of 2008, all that stuff had IPv6 on by default.
Absolutely, yeah. If we are talking about the Windows platform, anything starting from Vista, Windows 7, Server 2008, mm-hmm. comes with both IPv6 and IPv4 enabled as part of the operating system.
I guess the question is, because we don't touch our IPv6 stacks, are they actually doing anything?
Okay, so that's going to be the tricky one. Whenever I go and talk to any customer about IPv6 readiness, or if they have some concerns on IPv6 deployment, this is the number one question that comes up mm-hmm. during my discussion, right? Let me go through a couple of examples here.
Sure.
So the Windows imaging team is starting to deploy a Windows 7 desktop or a Server 2008 server images, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the first question that comes up is, hey, IPv6 comes enabled by default. So now I start rolling out those machines in the network. What is the impact, right? So does it create any performance issues? Does it create any security holes?
Isn't the real thing we're walking towards here, should I turn it off?
Absolutely.
So right.
this is where, again, talking with the different customers, what I find is the easy option that people prefer is, I don't see a need for IPv6,
right.
Which means there is nothing in my corporate or nothing in my business which forces me to go ahead and deploy IPv6 today. So maybe the easy option I would go ahead and do it is just turn it off. I don't know how that protocol works. I don't have to learn about how the 128-bit addressing looks like. So the easy option for me is to just turn it off and move on.
And I got to say, there's sort of a legitimate side of, I'm just going to reduce my surface area. It's not something
Absolutely.
I need on. I'll turn it off.
Absolutely, because you may even come across some of the Microsoft documentation saying, if you don't need something, please go ahead and turn it off, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of a catch-22, but the way I typically address that question to my customer is, The key here is, as I said, it's not going to be a typical migration. It's going to be a parallel deployment, which means end of the day, 100% of my network is still running on IPv4.
Right.
Right. So when I bring up these machines, which has dual stack enabled, both IPv4 and IPv6, I should be able to communicate both to my IPv4 network and also any IPv6 devices that I'm bringing up on my network. Right.
Okay.
So the key here is understanding how the dual stack concept works in Windows.
Yeah.
Right. So this is where we see a lot of awareness is needed. Right. I'm not saying there will be zero impact, but it's not scary as everyone thinks.
Okay. I guess I need to know the rules, because in theory, having two stacks, even though I'm doing it these days, is scary because I don't necessarily know what it's going to do.
Okay, so maybe I'll go through a couple of scenarios here which will help us to understand this.
Right.
So let's say you bring up a server, again, it could be a server 2012 or a server 2008 R2 mission.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it comes with the dual stack enabled. So under the covers, this is what happens. In the IPv6 world, there is something called link local address. If I have to compare that to an IPv4 terminology, all of us are used to something called private addressing. Again, the easy example I can give is, if you make your Windows IPv4 client as a DHCP client, and let's say you don't have any DHCP server, you will get an address which typically starts with 169.254, what we call as a APIPA automatic private addressing.
Right.
Okay, again, I'm explaining the IPv4 concepts here.
Yeah,
right?
That's an IPv4 concept, that's just not routable.
Correct, exactly. So that address is not a routable address. And comparing this terminology to an IPv6, there is something called link local address that get generated as soon as you go ahead and turn on IPv6 stack. Okay? So the link local address is not a routable address. It doesn't get registered in DNS. Okay? So two golden rules. So the impact here is, let's say we have a client which is trying to communicate to a server. In a typical world, what happens? The client is going to go to DNS and say, hey, I need to go ahead and resolve the name, appserver1.contoso.com.
Right.
Now, the fact that link local address don't get registered in DNS, guess what? The DNS has a record, which is the host record, pointing to the IPv4 address of the server.
Okay.
Right? So now the client gets the IPv4 address response from the DNS. Now, client just communicates to the server in IPv4, which means even though we have the IPv6 stack enabled, and the fact that link local address don't get registered in DNS,
mm-hmm.
everything happens magically in IPv4. There are no double work. There are no performance issues. We are not retrying any other protocols.
Awesome. That's a great answer. And just to be clear then, is there DHCP in the IPv6 world? Do I need to deal with that at all?
Absolutely. Okay, so that brings the other topic. On a high level, DHCP works similar to what we are used to in IPv4 world.
Right.
Okay, so what I mean by that is, you go ahead and set up your DHCP scopes, and you start defining your options and subnets and scopes. Everything, you will still continue to do it in IPv6 world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The only difference that people need to understand here is, again, I'm trying to compare to an IPv4.
Sure.
Because it's easy for people to relate to IPv4. In IPv4, yes, I can push the addresses via DHCP, or the other option is I can go ahead and configure those addresses manually on the servers.
Right.
In IPv6, yes, I can still go ahead and configure those manual addresses, assuming you are okay in configuring a 128-bit address.
Yeah.
And I can still go ahead and configure those scopes in DHCP and push out those addresses. There is a third way of doing things in IPv6, which is you can actually push out those addresses directly from the routers. Okay? So what we call as a stateless addressing.
Interesting.
So this is where, again, this is based on the support issues that we see typically from customers. This is where, again, I'm talking about a typical enterprise scenario where right. the router needs to be configured with the proper flags and all the discovery information and everything. So when you boot up a client which has an IPv6 enabled, the client actually goes and looks for the router discovery information. Okay? So if the assuming the router is configured properly with all the proper subnet information and everything, I can actually hand out those addresses directly from the routers without going through DHCP.
Interesting. And I was always taught, or at least maybe I'm understanding this wrong, that anything that can support IPv6 automatically has an address anyway that somehow involves the MAC. Like there's so many unique addresses that everybody has a unique address by default.
I mean, are you referring about how the IPv6 address is formulated on each of the devices?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is where, again, I'm taking a step back and mm-hmm. maybe give you a high level explanation on how a typical IPv6 address is formed, right? So we are talking about, in IPv4, we are used to the concept of the subnet mask, the network ID, host ID, and everything, right?
Right.
If I have to compare that to an IPv6 address, typically the first 64 bit forms the subnet, which is called link.
Okay.
It's called link in IPv6 terminology. The remaining 64 bit is what we call as an interface ID, which is nothing but the host ID if I have to compare this to an IPv4 world.
Right.
Okay. So the subnet link is something that you either configure in the router level, or depending on the DHCP scope, you can configure the subnet scope for those clients, right?
Okay.
So that leaves the remaining 64 bits, which is the interface ID. So this is something that gets generated automatically by the Windows devices.
Nice.
Based on some kind of a hashing algorithm. So imagine it basically uses a combination of the hardware components and everything installed on the device. So it comes up with a random interface ID. So it's difficult for people to actually tie the interface ID to a machine so that I cannot put a protocol analyzer or something and start looking at the traffic so that I know I won't be able to know from which machine it's actually coming from.
Oh, okay. That's cool. And I like the idea that there's part of the address that has to do with the network itself, that host part, and then part that is part of the device itself.
Absolutely.
Okay. And it just changes my mindset on DHCP somewhat, that really I'm really applying is to give devices in my network a consistent host.
Correct. Absolutely.
Okay. And now we can, and I hate to jump back and forth a bit, because now I want to talk about name resolution, because I love this idea that IPv6 tries to do name resolution, finds only IPv4 name resolution, and so lives in IPv4.
Correct.
Beautiful, and it just speaks to how clearly this is not going to cost us anything. It's just not a big deal to have that on.
But exactly. Just to take one step further, so let's say as a network admin and as a Windows admin, now I want to go ahead and configure a global IPv6 address on my Windows machine, right?
Okay.
So let's say if I go and do that, now if I go ahead and put an IP config on my Windows machine, yes, I'm going to have an IPv4 address, and I'm going to have the link local address like we talked about earlier. And on top of that, the global IPv6 address or the public IPv6 address that I explicitly configured. Mm-hmm. So in other words, I'm taking an action either driven by a Windows network admin or the router admin, right? So this is where things get a little bit interesting. So because the global IPv6 address, they do get registered in DNS as a quad A record.
Right.
So for a given machine, now we have two records. One is a record pointing to IPv4 and yep. a quad A record pointing to IPv6 address.
Okay.
So in this scenario, if we have to go back the same example where a client is looking to communicate to a server, now the fact that both quad A record and A record is resolvable from DNS, the default behavior in Windows Now, this is the time it's going to try communicating in IPv6 over IPv4.
Okay.
But the key part is somebody is taking an explicit action, so they know what they are doing before we start talking about this scenario.
All right, let's not presume I know what I'm doing here. But so DNS services in 2008 R2 or in 2012, I can turn on the IPv6 options, can't I? It's there.
Yeah, I mean, the DNS starting from server 2008 supports registering those IPv6 records as a quad A record.
Right. So I'm basically setting a flag that says now when IPv6 looks for DNS, you're going to respond and register your name.
Absolutely.
And so now you're actually going to start speaking IPv6 on my network, because up to now you haven't been.
Correct. And again, the expectation here is the router team has also configured the IPv6 routing on the routers. So which means the IPv6 is typically gets routed like how they route the IPv4 today.
Right. Well, and I guess this gets into the interesting part about this. I don't have any problem with my level 2, level 3, or layer 2, layer 3 switches. They're just going to pass the stuff along. It's
correct.
Above that, when we actually talk about routers, that they need to have more intelligence and actually understand IPv6.
Absolutely. So that brings up another concern that we typically run into with the customer, right? So mm-hmm. The IPv6, end of the day, it's a layer 3 network layer protocol,
right?
So typically what people are doing today to go ahead and manage IPv4, when I say manage from a security perspective, hey, how do I protect my DMZ network? How do I do the intrusion detection system?
Yep.
What are the firewall rules and ACLing and everything? People have to still follow all those methodology when it comes to IPv6,
mm-hmm.
right? So I still have to protect my layer 2. Like, again, this is a simple example. I typically give it to my customers. So imagine an IPv4 network. Today, I can bring my laptop and come into your network, and I can run a DHCP server on my machine.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I get access to one of your network tab, I can actually start handing out wrong DHCP addresses to your network.
Absolutely.
And effectively bringing your network down.
Yeah. How many times have we seen this happen at a big conference?
Exactly.
Some renegade VM, not even malicious, but just a VM, you know, out on the network, inside of the hotel, inside of the convention, handing out IP addresses, just ripping stuff up.
Absolutely. So if in an IPv6 world, the fact that we talked about, hey, I can go ahead and configure those addresses directly from the routers, yeah, technically I can bring up a wrong router in my network,
mm-hmm.
and start handing out wrong IPv6 addresses.
Right.
Right? So this is not a layer 3 problem. I have to protect layer 2 using technologies like maybe 802.1x or maybe some port blocking at the switch level. So
yep.
That's where people need to understand IPv6 is a layer 3 protocol.
Yeah. Okay, so it's still the same problems. You're not going to make me, we've been told that IPv6 is going to fix all kinds of problems, but this is still an issue.
Absolutely. The way I typically answer is IPv6 is not or less secure compared to IPv4.
Really? Because I thought one of the advantages of IPv6 was this, that IPsec was there all the time. Like, there's a lot of stuff that we developed over time in IPv4 that are all base options now in IPv6 that we should be able to expect IPsec.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's more from an implementation perspective.
Okay.
Because IPsec is a standard from day one,
yep.
which is part of the IPv6 protocol. So when we are talking about vendor implementation, now they have a consistent standard to stick to go ahead and implement IPsec, which was not the case in IPv4 because things like the quality of service, QoS,
yeah.
and IPsec.
Multicast, too.
Afterthought, after the protocol was developed.
Yeah, and that's, I also thought multicast was such a great idea that never worked in IPv4 because you
Absolutely.
Couldn't count on the routers.
Yep, because the concept of the broadcast goes away in IPv6.
Right. So, all of these things are true, but it still means we still have to follow rules and set stuff up correctly.
Absolutely.
All right. So, internally, when it comes to routing, is this just an upgrade to hardware? Are you finding that most of the time, or are people needing to buy new hardware for internal routing?
Okay, I would say no, just for a simple reason. Like before even we talk about all the enterprise gear, mm-hmm. so let's say I go to maybe like one of the electronic store like Best Buy or something and trying to get a D-Link router or a Link 6 router.
Yep.
I mean, it supports IPv6 out of the box, right? Yeah. So when we are talking about enterprise-based devices, I would say my experience is at least if the device is like 5 to 6 years old, it's going to support IPv6 by default.
Okay.
So there should not be any surprise.
Anything 5 years old or newer, it's just a non-issue. It's going to work.
Absolutely.
Yeah. When we get to the edge of our network and get out into the world, now it's more of an issue about our ISPs and so forth.
Correct. The typical problem people may run into is, this is where it becomes a little bit tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Your operating system comes with IPv6 enabled. Most of your networking gears comes with IPv6 enabled. But in a big enterprise, they may have some custom written tool, right?
Right.
And a security team may say, hey, I'm going to use this tool to go and query who are all the members of a local administrator group in every mission, right?
Yep.
So those are the things which needs to be tracked. Hey, can my tool now work across IPv6? Am I hard coding anything in my tool which looks for an IPv4 address, right? So those are the kind of red flags that people have to go and scan. Okay, am I losing my functionality because I just turned on another protocol in my network?
And I guess you always have to wonder, what protocol am I actually using when these machines are communicating with each other?
Absolutely.
Is there any easy way to tell?
Again, going back to the network analyzers,
right?
Which will, again, any network analyzers like Wireshark or NetMon should I can always, the example that we go through between a client trying to communicate to a server, I can easily find out between the client and server using which protocol it is trying to communicate.
Okay. I guess the other thing is, why are we doing this? What are we actually getting from IPv6 for turning all of this on? Because we're not even going to try and get outside of our local network. You know, are there benefits? We've clearly identified that if IPv6 is on and not configured, it doesn't hurt anything. But do I get something? Should I go through this process?
Okay, so that's again the tricky question that, like I said initially, the one question that always gets thrown back to me from the customer. Hey, okay, you want me to go ahead and turn on IPv6, but what are the business benefits, right?
End
of the day, what are the business benefits? So this is where it becomes a tricky decision of, okay, everyone knows the public IPv4 address pools are depleted, technically, right?
Yes.
So one easy scenario, which typically I tell the customers, so if you are a customer or service provider, who kind of runs a service in the internet world, right? You're mm-hmm. providing a service to the external internet, right? So now if you are looking at future expansion, which you don't even know what kind of expansion you make, guess what? You don't have any more public IPv4 addresses available,
right?
Yes, you can always use a translation device, which kind of pools multiple addresses into one common IPv4 address. But using those type of technology, you will still get into performance issues. So it's not a long-term solution, right?
Right.
It's a short-term fix, right? So one easy answer, if you are looking for providing services in the internet world, yes, you have to be looking at IPv6 as a long-term solution.
But it also means having an IPv6 capable ISP and dealing with all of those issues.
Absolutely.
Right.
And coming back to your question on, what are some of the benefits that I get internally? Okay, so this is where it gets interesting. So let's go through a couple of scenarios where mm-hmm. a company A goes and purchases part of a company B, right? That typically happens on a day-to-day basis.
Yep.
The first thing that comes in the picture is, hey, now how do I interconnect those two networks?
You have to have this great merging of the namespaces. Ask me how I know. Redoing the DHCP stack, sorting all the servers out. It's incredibly difficult.
Absolutely. And for the most part, people would have deployed maybe a private IPv4 address, like a 10 network or a 192 network.
Yes.
Now, guess what? Let's say both companies have deployed the same network addressing. Now, when I'm trying to interconnect, now the headache starts, right? Because now we are talking about NATing between two private IP networks. This is where the challenge begins.
Sure.
As a Microsoft person, I get almost once in 3 months from different customers, hey, I'm trying to spin up two domain controllers across a NAT. Will Microsoft support it? The simple answer we give is the operating system doesn't know what is happening at the network layer.
No.
Right? So if the NAT device can translate every packet at every layer without any issues, then we don't care. But in reality, we see most of the network device, NAT devices has issues when it comes to translating packets at the higher level, like DNS packets and everything, right? So the fact that the other benefit we are talking about here is it's a 128-bit IPv6 address.
Yep.
Technically, I can get rid of my NAT, right? Because
yeah.
Every PC can have a global IPv6 address.
Right.
So that's the other benefit, I would say. But off late, again, going back to business scenarios, what I'm seeing a couple of other things is voice over IP, right? So people are talking about replacing your old legacy style, PBX style phone with the voice over IP where you transmit your voice as a data packets in the IP network, right?
Right, VoIP.
So, yeah, so voice over IP is also an area where IPv6 is definitely going to be very, very useful because you don't have to go through this NAT, and we are talking about a peer-to-peer based communication.
Yeah.
And because the IPv6 provides that end-to-end connectivity.
We've also done shows on direct access, which is, to my mind, is the only product I know of that depends on IPv6.
Correct. At the enterprise level, yes. If
right.
you are talking about an enterprise-based app, direct access where you can be a remote worker and as an IT admin, I can manage your device as if you are sitting in the corporate.
Right. Yeah. And it's just, I mean, I like everything about direct access. It's just transparent connectivity, no pop-up dialogues. It works beautifully, but you've got to have IPv6 up and running.
Absolutely. The key is, yes, it provides that end-to-end connectivity. Doesn't matter where you're located.
Right. Are there other products in the Microsoft stacks that depend on IPv6 now?
Not at the enterprise level. There are like things like Microsoft Cluster and Branch Cache.
Mm-hmm.
Those technologies kind of uses IPv6 for their internal working.
Oh, okay.
So, but other than direct access, maybe I would say no.
Okay. Because you'd like to see something like maybe Exchange prefers IPv6 or you get better performance or better behavior out of that. But I don't even know if that's possible.
Yeah, again, that brings up to another topic, which is typically customer says, one of the questions that I get asked from the customer is, hey, I'm bringing up IPv6. Is it going to break down my application?
Yeah.
Is my app going to have issues, right? The short answer here is, as long as the app relies on the operating system to do the name resolution,
yes,
it's going to work because the legwork will be done by the operating system, like how we talked about earlier. Is it going to prefer a quad A record or is it going to prefer an A record?
Right.
So the app is completely transparent whether the TCP is talking in IPv6 or IPv4.
Well, if you're hard coding IP addresses into your app, you're already in hell. Don't do that.
Exactly.
You want to use yes. names and let the network stack do what it wants to do.
Absolutely.
That makes total sense, and it's just not that fearful. So are you advocating this now? Do you feel like it's advantageous to have a working IPv6 stack inside of the organization?
The short answer is yes, but this is where we get a lot of pushback for the reasons that we talked about, because there is no immediate benefit, right?
Right.
I mean, whether we like it or not, people want to see immediate benefit
yeah.
when they spend some time and start deploying and migration, right? So From a Microsoft product group standpoint, IPv6 is considered as a core component of the operating system.
Yep.
Right? So our recommendation generally is, unless you have a strong reason and you know why you are doing it, please keep the stack enabled.
Right. Yeah, so the default should be leave the stack enabled, but perhaps not configure any name services. What about
Absolutely.
IPv6 on Wi-Fi? Is there anything different?
I would say for the most part, again, this is where in an IPv6 terminology, there is something called mobile IPv6.
Right.
Again, I have not seen any real-life implementation. I don't think even Windows has that implemented in any of the products so far.
Okay.
But the conceptually, the mobile V6 is, let's say you have a connection between a mobile device to another device, right? Mm-hmm. And you terminate the connection, you take the device to a different location or a different place. You can technically still maintain that connection because the way mobile IPv6 works is it's not tied to the physical address that we are typically used to.
Right.
There is something called a home link concept where you address the packet to a proxy address. On the back, the proxy address actually ties it back to the actual physical location. Again, this is still only available, as far as I know, as a standard. But maybe if there are more business scenarios and more people asking it, then I can see people start implementing in their products.
Well, and I've talked to lots of organizations that are just struggling under the weight of how much wireless devices they have now. The number of phones, the number of tablets, the proliferation is amazing. Everybody's DHCP pool is too small now. The idea that largely this problem goes away with IPv6 is pretty appealing.
Correct. And that actually, again, this is another scenario also we ran into the customer is everybody is now talking on the BYOD, right? Bring your own device strategy.
Yeah.
So the idea here is, yes, I used to run those 20,000 desktops, each desktop sitting in my cube. Now I move all those desktops to the data center. Now I'm bringing up, like you said, a tablet device or a thin client. So now pretty much my number of network connections is doubled, right? Now I need to have 20,000 plus 20,000 IP addresses in my network,
yep.
Right? And also the other thing that we need to keep in mind, let's say you bring up a tablet device, which is typically unmanaged, right? So that's the whole concept of BYOD strategy.
Yes.
Now, guess what? We don't know whether the tablet is dual stack enabled, whether
yep.
we don't know whether it is going to tunnel any IPv6 packet inside IPv4 network. So it's very important from a network perspective, from a security perspective, they need to start putting those policies in place.
Right.
Hey, this tablet is coming into my network. Is it trying to talk IPv6? Can my packet analyzer looking at those traffic, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even though I'm not willing to enable IPv6, without me knowing it, the IPv6 traffic may be already happening on my network.
For sure. Well, and it also begs the question, at what point do we start demanding IPv6? At what point do we want to have IPv6 only devices in our network?
Correct, which, I mean, like I said, it's the fact that it's going to be a parallel migration effort. For the foreseeable future, the dual stack is going to be the key scenario for people to start embracing.
Yes.
So that way they can go back to IPv4. At the same time, they can also start communicating to the new IPv6 devices.
Yeah, I just think I could see myself as an administrator having a metric of how much of our traffic is V6 now versus V4.
Absolutely.
With an eye to, this is a migration strategy. Do you think it's feasible? I could have pure V6 internally and just have V4 gateways externally?
I would say technically yes, but I don't see that as a realistic option, at least maybe in the next 10 to 15 years.
Wow, that's a long time, Venkat. That is a long time. I think you might be a little pessimistic, my friend.
Yeah, I'm just going by, in terms of the business priorities
sure.
and business scenarios that people are getting to. So it's just one of those things where I feel IPv4 will still continue to play a role, at least on the internal network.
However small that might be, yeah.
Absolutely.
We had some hangers-on for NetBuoy for a long time before
oh,
the
yeah.
world became
NetBuoy
all TCP.
Oh, yeah, from the IPX, from the novel
yeah.
NetWare world. Yeah, that actually, okay, maybe this I should have told this when I was talking about the name resolution. I know a lot of customers, when it comes to IPv4, they continue to rely on the WINS, the NetBIOS name resolution. When it comes to IPv6, IPv6 has no relevance on WINS, has
yep.
no relevance on NetBIOS. So which means you need to have foolproof DNS strategy for resolving any IPv6-based addresses.
Sure. That's important. Yeah, you'll need to be able to do that. It just speaks to exactly that. If you haven't gotten rid of your WINS demands, your NetBuoy demands, you're going to have a tough time. You've got to move that stuff forward.
Absolutely. Again, the reason I'm making that is I know a lot of, at least few third-party vendors. Again, this is not something you will run into if you are running a Microsoft DNS. But I know third-party vendors who may license their the DNS device based on the number of addresses you register in DNS,
yep.
Right? So that way the people don't enable dynamic updates.
Mm-hmm.
So those strategy may have to be revisited.
Sure. No, I think we've come to a conclusion. We need dynamic updating now. It's almost impossible to live without it as soon as you have any substantial number of devices.
Yep.
There's so much more to talk about, but I think we're about out of time. Venkat, thanks so much for coming on the show. This is really a lot of fun, and it encourages me to push more IPv6 activations internally.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure talking to you, Richard.
You bet. And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.